All right. So I've switched on the recording. We're recording now. We're talking about divorce and what the Bible actually says, what it says in the Torah, and what is the instruction. All right, where do you want to begin?
Hang
on, I have to tell everyone, we're talking to Yoel Ben Shlomo, my Hebrew teacher, and we're talking about divorce because, you know, it comes up from time to time, and it's one of those topics that's really, really complicated, and it usually has to do with the... No, I'm not going to say that. I'm not going to bring that into the topic. Let's stick with the Tanakh. What does it say?
What does it say? Okay. So first of all, let's clarify something. We just started a discussion over the issue of divorce. You made a study about this several years ago. Mm-hmm. And this question has been thrown at me several times regarding this issue. And it's a bit tricky because I've seen strange, erratical behavior when people are dealing with this. Misunderstandings of the verses and silly oaths that people take when they get married.
Sure.
Okay, so let's first of all start off exactly defining the issue of what is marriage. Marriage in the Tanakh, we don't have, the Torah doesn't define how you get married, the Torah doesn't define what is the definition of marriage, how you do it, etc. We have very few verses. One verse is in Genesis where it says, the man takes a woman and they become one flesh. That's
he leaves his mother and father and he cleaves unto his wife and they become one flesh.
Exactly. And sometimes when people do Noahide marriages, they quote that verse and become one flesh. Basically, they become as one. This is also a very good hint to all married couples to treat each other as if it's themselves.
Very good advice.
It's a very, very good piece of advice. I'll share something here with everyone. As everyone knows, I'm married. I actually have kids. Mm. I got married very, very young. I was only 20 years old, so I've been married for... I was almost 21. I'm going to reveal my age. I'm almost 30. 29 going on 30.
Yeah. And so you've been married for 9 years, right?
Eight and a half years. Yeah. I've been married for 8.5 years.
Okay.
And... it is, when I first got married, I had no idea what it meant.
Yeah.
Very, very clear. A lot of people get married. I mean, the society I live in, I lived in then, people strive to get married very, very young.
Mm-hmm.
And I actually witnessed a marriage of a 17-year-old. Two weddings.
Wow.
I apologize. Two weddings I attended. One as a close friend of the groom, and another one as a... just a neighbor.
Mm-hmm.
I wasn't invited because I just
you live there.
You know, friends of friends. So the groom said, if they know of anyone that can come, please come. And I did. So I arrived at the wedding.
Nice.
The groom was 17 yeah. years old.
Wow.
And it really depends. Now they're still married, by the way. But what happens is you go through turmoils. I mean, everyone who's married out there, unless you're that couple that I met from Hawaii, who've been together for over 20 years. Amazing couple. I mean, if they hear this recording, I just want to say hi. You know, yeah. So the couple who know who they are, I really miss you guys. It was great meeting you. Using the radio for this. But, you know, I mean, what I saw, there was a couple that really, really bonded together in an amazing way. And I wish all marriages were like that.
Mm.
I wish everyone had a happy, wonderful marriage, and they get married, and life is wonderful to begin with. I know the turmoils, you know, money, no money. When you first get married, I mean, I was under 21 when I got married.
Mm-hmm.
Money, I had no money, you know, basically.
Mm-hmm.
I had no money. We had a very low income.
So you were married. You're almost 21. You didn't have much money when you got married, and isn't it usually the case, at least in my observation, that financial situations are often the cause of major stress and therefore major arguments, and then you get to really find out how much you love each other?
Yeah, it's actually one of the big tests. I mean, I've met, but again, that's not the only thing that tests that, because I know also couples that had money,
mm-hmm.
and in the end they got divorced because the character was the problem. Mm-hmm. So let's cover a few things about marriage in the ancient world, and I would say somewhat in the modern Orthodox, the American concept, but what happens in the modern world of the Orthodox Jews. First of all, if you belong to the ultra orthodox, you will see more of the ancient style. But let's go originally went on. First of all, women got married at a very young age.
Mm-hmm.
We're talking that there was a possibility they got married at the age of 12 or 13. Mm-hmm. The moment they were ready to have children, they got married.
Sure.
This is why, for example, having a 20-year-old king or a 16-year-old king is not something unusual, because people became adults at a younger age.
Yeah, we live in a society these days, particularly in Western culture, where we're not encouraged to become adults until we're sort of in our mid or even late 20s now. We're still children, and we still want to act like children, and we don't know what it means for us men. We don't know what it means to be a man. And that's a problem today in today's culture. But back during the times of the Tanakh, I mean, my goodness, it's the case.
So what I would say about this is that if you grew up in a mentality, this is one of the things that people tell me. You know, the group that came here to Israel, they met me and they said, "Oh, I'll do 29. How many kids do you have? 4. They look at you, they blink several times before they say anything because they're in shock. But it really depends which society you live in.
Sure.
I know of families who didn't have kids but until they were like in their 30s.
Mm.
And these people were just trying to have fun for a while when they got married. They wanted to still be boyfriend, girlfriend for a while.
Mm.
And they didn't want to – they married because they want to express their love, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. But they didn't want to have any kids until they're like in the mid to sometimes late 30s, because they wanted to enjoy life as a couple, and they wanted to seal it as a marriage. So yes, I mean, one of the problems you have today in today's society is that people get married and they have no idea what it means. The divorce rate in the U.S. is insane.
Oh, it's incredible.
The number of people I've met that got married 2, 3, 4 times is insane.
Mm.
And people get married for the wrong reasons.
Yeah.
Now, if you're in love, okay, then you have to remember something very, very important. And you know, you have to take it from perspective that I know I'm young, and maybe some of the people listening to this are in their 40s or 50s, and they're always too young to even know. No, the answer is, don't confuse love with lust, basically.
Amen.
One of the problems that people think is that they see, and I'm directing this more to men, but what happens sometimes when we're still very childish, we think we're in love.
Hmm.
We think that, by the way, I majored in philosophy, so I'm allowed to speak about this. we think we're in love. We think that we know it all, and we don't.
Hmm.
We don't. And we make mistakes.
And so to differentiate between lust and love, I mean, because when you're in love, the fireworks can still go off, and you may still have stars in your eyes, and everything is wonderful and beautiful. But I suppose maybe the difference is: are you thinking about a family with this person? Are you thinking about the rest of your life with this person? Can you imagine what that's going to be like? And can you accept the responsibilities that you're taking on? And it's not just extending your covenant of marriage to her, but it's all the responsibilities that you have to take on with marriage and building a family and securing a job and so on and so forth. Is that fair? Those kind of things are outside of the realm of just lust, right?
Exactly, exactly. Now, even if you love someone, let's be very, very clear, even if you love someone, you still have to think, can I build a relationship with this person? Can I build a family with this person? And when I say family, I'm not even going yet to the issue of children.
Mm-hmm.
I'm going to the issue of taking responsibility of running a house together, taking the responsibility of, we need something in the house. Don't turn around to your spouse and say, oh, you do it. No. You need to do it as well.
Mm-hmm.
Okay? But again, also take the responsibility of working, paying the bills, making sure there's food on the table, doing everything you have to do, keeping a house, and if you have children, and believe me, I know this, I have 4 of them, high maintenance. You really have to work hard on your relationship. You have to work hard on your marriage itself, on your household, on everything.
Your priorities and your responsibilities, yeah.
And this is why divorce rate is so high.
Because it comes as a shock to a lot of people, doesn't it?
Yeah, you don't. Let me tell you something. I heard this from several friends of mine who are secular, who had a girlfriend,
mm-hmm.
and they decide to move in with the girlfriend. And as long as you don't have the commitment you live together and you can break it up whatever, whenever you want. Though we have to have a discussion how exactly we define marriage. And there's a bit of I had a few arguments with people, but obviously, you know, when I say argument, by the way, I've said this many times about arguments. The difference in between the types of arguments we have in the Jewish world and the arguments that sometimes people have outside the Jewish world is we have friendly arguments. Mm. We argue and we remain friends. We can argue over a cup of coffee and still remain friends, though we can have a very fierce argument and be very angry with one another. It doesn't mean we stop being friends. Sure. We don't run around pointing at each other saying, false teaching, false teaching. We don't do that. We don't. I've seen it. It's kind of. I've watched a few videos. I do apologize. I'm giggling. It just made me laugh when I saw it. But I saw a few videos of people accusing each other of false teaching, and I'm going like, "People, learn to live with one another. We do it."
Yeah, that's right. I mean, you and I, we can have rather maybe even heated discussions about a passage in the Bible. But once we get off the topic, we're off the topic. It's over. We did that, and now we're still friends.
Yeah, exactly.
Even though you're wrong, it's okay.
So what exactly does it mean to get married in the ancient world?
I was
about to talk about secular friends. So basically they move in with their girlfriend and it's still okay. When they get married, then the rings on the finger, if you put a ring on your finger, you'd be surprised most religious Jewish men do not put a ring on their finger. Mm-hmm. When I walk around with a ring, And a lot of my Orthodox friends kind of like, "Why are you walking around with a ring?" Because I love my wife. I want to look at my hand and remember her.
Sure.
But I can't put it on my right hand because it disturbs me when you try to write something. So put it on your left hand, obviously. Mm-hmm. But one of the things I discovered was when they got married, suddenly it changes. Mm. She allows herself not to look that pretty in the morning. Mm-hmm. He allows himself not to put down the toilet seat. he leaves all the towels wet in the bathroom instead of putting them in the washing machine. She will make certain noises he's not used to. She's not that pretty without makeup on.
Oh, and she is. She's better without makeup.
And then the love, you realize your love is superficial.
That's right.
You realize you do love the person, but it was very superficial. Mm. You have to start working on the love inwards. Mm-hmm. And one of the really amazing things, if you're really in love with your wife, is that you don't even have the mental possibility of looking at another woman. Because the only person that flashes in your head is your wife. And that's
not necessarily just a, like I said before, a stars in the eyes sort of thing. It's not necessarily a lust thing. It's an acknowledgement of, and it's not even just excitement. It's an acknowledgement of responsibility. It's acknowledgement. Now, this comes back to the definition of marriage. We don't have a set definition of marriage in Torah, but what we do see is we have examples. And the way I understand it, you let me know if you think this is correct, because the way I understand it is that the man has a God-given right to extend a covenant of marriage to a woman.
But let me describe what marriage was in the ancient world, and let's see if we go there.
Sure.
If we're on the same page.
Let's do it.
Okay, so what was exactly marriage? So as I mentioned, women were considered to be owned. Okay, all the feminists are going to start screaming and yelling that the Bible is evil. No, that was the mentality of the ancient world. But the Bible itself does not, you know, the Bible on the technical level, it treats it that way. On the non-technical level, you go to the book of Malachi. He speaks in the second chapter. He speaks about the issue of marriage and how he's, mm-hmm. You know, she is your friend, the one of covenant and everything. Mm-hmm. You know, when you love a woman, you don't treat her as an object.
She's his treasured possession. Yeah.
So men, go out there and remember that your wife is a treasured possession, and she's not a possession. She's your friend. She's your second half.
Mm. But the first thing we see in the Torah, God says, you know, I should make a match, a partner for Adam, someone comparable to him, to be a helper. Now, is this a fair translation?
The word there is Ezer Kenegdo. And the word Ezer is usually from the word Azar, Ezra, which is help. But I think there's, you know, help, but I think there's a deeper meaning here. that if we don't have our wives, we're not complete.
Let's admit it. I mean, us men, we need assistance, right? We need assistance.
We men need our wives. Mm-hmm. It's deeper than that. I mean, we need our spouse. Mm. What we see there, the Bible is trying to teach us a lot of things. Let's be very clear about it. The Bible tries to teach us a lot of things. The Bible is not only a technical issue. I mean, I mentioned this quite a few times. The Bible is not only technical. Okay, there's technicalities. I agree. Mm-hmm. But the Torah itself and the Bible itself is trying to teach us something completely different. It's teaching us to obey, and it's also teaching us to love one another. And we micro it even more. It teaches us to love our wives as well. Mm-hmm. And if you actually look at the book of Hosea, you know, you have to ask yourself a very, very simple question. What on earth is going on in the first and second chapters? I mean, Hosea's commanded to marry an adulterous woman?
Yeah.
And depending on certain interpretations, twice? Yeah. Two different women who are adulterous. There's one way of looking at it that he's marrying. It's a repeat of the same action. There's another way of reading it where he's marrying two different women, mm-hmm. and you're asking yourself, what on earth is going on here? What is this behavior? Mm. But what it teaches us, for example, there's two things it teaches us there on the divine level and on the human level. On the human level, it teaches us that we have to love our wives. If she's adulterous, that's something completely different. Okay, if someone's wife is caught in an act of adultery, then we have to go on the technical level. Mm. But a person has to learn to love his spouse. A man has to learn to love his wife and try to stay with her no matter what, mm-hmm. unless it's just complete hell. And that's what we call grounds for divorce.
So the book of Hosea really is a book highlighting the faithfulness of God, right?
Yes. Mm. I read a very interesting book, and I highly recommend this book to everyone out there. I'm telling you, I don't recommend too many books. There's a few of them which I do highly recommend. Mm-hmm. I just finished reading the first half of a book called The Prophets by a man called Rabbi Abraham Joshua Heschel, I think. Is it Joshua or Abraham? I think it's Abraham Joshua Heschel. He is a fascinating writer. And he wrote a book called The Prophets. And he introduces different aspects of prophecy. Some of it more of a philosophical way, some of it more of a biblical way. And in the introduction to the book of Hosea, mm-hmm. He doesn't cover all the prophets. He goes to prophets that he understood have a major message in what they say. Mm-hmm. And in the copy, I bought a secondhand copy printed somewhere in the 70s. It was cheaper to buy it that way. Very good quality book. And I opened up the book and I started reading the introduction, everything introduced, what the prophets are, what their purpose was. I suggest this for everyone because it gives you a very, very good idea of how Judaism looks at prophecy, mm-hmm. and also gives you interesting twists that you usually don't notice unless you're highly absorbed in the prophets and you're trying to find the inner meaning. Mm-hmm. But for me being a Jew, you don't always see it. So I do agree there are things, specifically when it comes to the Bible, there are things that we lose or miss out when we look through the Bible, but we all do it. Even, you know, people who believe in Yeshua also do the exact same thing. Mm-hmm. So I actually strongly say we all have to learn from one another. And this is why, for example, I'm going to mention him again, Rico Cortez and I are such good friends. We agree to disagree and we learn from one another all the time.
Amen. Right. Well, that's good. No, really? No, thanks for, I know you've actually mentioned that book to me before, and I'm glad you've reminded me of that. So I'm going to look that up. And what you're saying is it has an excellent introduction to Hosea, which is so relevant to the topic because we see the unfaithfulness of Gomer, and we see that he's instructed to take her back, though she is unfaithful, though she is a harlot, and we see the faithfulness of God. And God would expect us to act like him, right? We are to learn from our Father in heaven. Is that fair?
Yeah. I would agree, but you have to take understanding everything. You really need to read the whole book to understand it. Mm. He makes very, very good analogy of the entire subject. Mm. But what was funny is my copy of the book, I open it up and I look at the chapter about Hosea, and it has whoever owned the book before me wrote inside love next to the name of Hosea. Yeah. And I said, okay, maybe this chapter is about love. And I try reading it, and it is. He does a very interesting thing there. He speaks about the emotions of God. He he talks about the emotional aspect of prophecy and what the prophet feels when he's told certain things. And he takes that chapter and speaks about the issue of love, and he says that God loves Israel. Mm-hmm. And what the chapter teaches us is no matter what we do, God will still love us. We have to treat our spouse the same way. You know, but again, we also have the technicalities. We have to understand most of the marriages end for no real reason. People just go into these petty little fights. If a man catches his woman, you know, in an adulterous position, or this is what we don't consider adultery in the Torah, but if a woman catches her husband also in a so-called quote-unquote adulterous behavior, then that will be good ground for a divorce. But in general, you know, he never takes out the garbage. Oh, yeah. So work on it.
So work on it.
But if the spouse is an alcoholic, a drug addict, you know, stuff like that, I get the idea. Okay.
Sure. So some things take more work than others. But what you're saying is it's not unusual. And I've heard many stories where massive rifts have happened in marriages because of small things that just escalate and escalate, and they escalate because people just won't work them out. And what we see in Hosea is that God loves Israel and he is faithful to Israel. And we see this in Hosea as the husband to Gomer. But in any case, it makes you ask questions, because we also read in, I think it's Malachi, it says God hates divorce. And then there are all of these questions when you're trying to join all of these passages up in the Tanakh, and we end up in places like Deuteronomy 24, chapter 24, verses 1 to 4 that you and I were talking about earlier. Do you want to focus in on some of these?
So let me just finish describing what marriage is, and then we'll just deal with divorce. In the ancient times, what they did is that a man would want to marry a woman. He would approach her father and say, I want to marry your daughter. Mm-hmm. They arrange an agreement. It's called the Mohar Betulot. They reach an agreement how much the man would pay the father for the daughter. We also have cases, for example, the Torah speaks of a man who rapes a woman, then he has to pay a very specific sum of money to the father, a pretty large sum, and he marries her. They do a whole festive thing. We don't know of any specific ceremony. Today we have a ceremony in Judaism. You stand under the chuppah, which is the thing you have on top on the poles, and there's a rabbi. He does a blessing over the betrothal. Mm-hmm. He who forbid us the married and allow us only there's a whole list of things either who allowed us only through marriage and everything, basically sanctifying the concept of marriage, that entering betrothal is a covenant, it's a serious matter, and you don't take it easily, and it's lightly.
And then there's the object lesson of the glass, breaking the glass. Can you tell us what that means?
Oh, the glass is a relatively new thing. It's not something that has no real meaning. Well, it has a real meaning, but it has no meaning to do with marriage. Mm-hmm. I'll touch on that in a second. And then there's like blessings over the there's a blessing over a glass of wine, and then the blessing of the betrothal. And then they read from the Ketubah, which is a rabbinical document developed in the first century, basically trying to protect the rights of women, because women, when they got divorced in certain situations, they got nothing. When a woman divorced in the ancient world, she went back to her father's house. If she was divorced and she has children, then the father has to take care of the children, but she has to find a different husband. So it is a bit of an issue. So to protect the woman, what they did is they created this reality that if a man divorces his wife, he has to pay her money to keep her on her feet. Uh-huh. Not alimony, but he divorces her. When they get married, he writes down this thing called a ketubah. He writes down how much he will pay her if he divorces her. And sometimes people use it to scare the husbands from divorcing their wives. I've heard of ketubot of $1 million. And this husband doesn't have $1 million. That's to scare him from divorcing. Think twice about divorcing.
Sure.
Because the understanding is many divorces are just for no real reason.
And so here's an example of him entering into an additional contract on top of his marriage covenant, if you like, which is something that we also see today. The example,
premarital agreements.
Yeah, premarital. We see that, and we also see the addition. I won't go into the details, but
one very important thing that happens is that, for example, dating in the religious world is not very long. Sometimes it's almost non-existent. There's a fixed marriage, for example. You're going to marry her. End of story. Sometimes dating a woman is very, very quick. I mean, people who date for 2-3 months and they decide to get married. You know, people have been asked, "How do you know?" So, how do you know who she is? And my answer, my response is, even if you date them for a year or two, you still don't know who they are.
True.
Until you get married.
True. And so, if you're looking at it from the right perspective, and you're saying this is a partnership, a covenant that I want to make work, and I'm willing to accept the responsibility, and you go into it with that in mind, well, then you're right. I mean, because you're still not going to learn. Believe me. You won't learn exactly who she is for years after your marriage. You'll still be learning who she is.
Exactly.
Yeah.
So that's the technicality of marriage. So really, marriage is the going into the bedroom and fulfilling the marriage. And that's how it was understood in the ancient world. Mm-hmm. In Western culture today, you know, one of the sad things is that people treat the relations between a man and a woman only on the aspect of fun. And not as a deep emotional thing. And I remember I sat down with a bunch of secular people I know, and I tell them, this is not only a physical enjoyment, there's a mental part to it. Mm-hmm. And you're wasting something beautiful over just having fun. Mm-hmm. It's a shame. You're ruining something important and beautiful. And that's the whole thing. I mean, for example, food, and I as a cook can say this, food is an amazing thing. But when you abuse it and you overeat or you eat unhealthy, you're making yourself unhealthy. You're ruining who you are. Mm. Same thing about this. A person who's out there only to have fun and sleeps around with whatever is willing to sleep with him, he's only ruining who he is or she, only destroying who you are.
That's a good analogy. I like that. That's true.
Yeah. Because really in the world, there are two things which are real joy for human beings. That human beings put a lot of effort into. One is food, the other one is sex, to be very, very clear. So
that's marriage. That's basically marriage. So do you want to look at any examples, or do you want to what shall we do with that then?
We have now bonus the concept of marriage. Well, today we have ceremonies, things like that. You put a ring on your finger, la di la di la. Oh, by the way, a very important issue in marriage in the Jewish world is in the ancient world is that you buy the woman. Mm-hmm. You actually buy her from the father. Mm-hmm. So, the practice today to give a woman a ring, for example, wasn't always the practice in Judaism. A man could offer a goat for the woman, you know, wasn't necessarily what it is. But part of the issue of putting the ring, when you put the ring on the woman's finger, you say, you are put aside or sanctified to me as the laws of Israel and Moses. Mm. Sorry, the laws of Moses and Israel. Okay? So putting the ring on is a very symbolic thing of basically finishing off. The ring is actually the betrothal. And you put the ring on and you said, now we're together. Now we're in covenant together.
If you like, it is a sign of the covenant, if you like.
Exactly. Okay. So married women in the Jewish world always have a ring on their finger. But the marriage itself has to do with the fact that they went with the man and fulfilled the marriage. Mm-hmm. And that's marriage. And then you just build marriage on from that point onwards, and hopefully everyone will be happy with the other side. Mm. But if it doesn't work... Okay, now we have to touch on what exactly will be the grounds for divorce. Mm-hmm. And that takes us to Deuteronomy 24.
This is what it says in the New King James. When a man takes a wife and marries her, and it happens that she finds no favor in his eyes because he has found some uncleanness in her, note, and he writes her a certificate of divorce, puts it in her hand, and sends her out of his house, when she has departed from his house and goes and becomes another man's wife, if the latter husband detests her and writes her a certificate of divorce, puts it in her hand and sends her out of his house, or if the latter husband dies who took her as a wife, then, as verse 4, her former husband who divorced her must not take her back to be his wife after she has been defiled, for that is an abomination before the Lord, and you shall not bring sin on the land which the Lord your God is giving you as an inheritance.
Okay, so first of all, I would say this. I don't like the tone you read the first verse, and I know why, because that's what we were arguing about. You presented the first verse as a, how would you call it, a plausible hypothetical cause. We don't read it that way. Mm-hmm. We read it that when a man marries a woman and he does not have a liking to her, mm-hmm. he finds in the note ervat davar in her. Mm-hmm. He is to divorce her by giving her a letter of divorce.
So this is just so people
full
understand.
Full stop. Then we carry on the hypothetical discussion. If she goes and she marries someone else, blah, 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 it's the exact opposite of what you're trying to read.
Okay, hang on. Let me just make it clear to the listeners. The disagreement that we had, Yoel and I, is that I read the first three verses of chapter 24 in Deuteronomy as a hypothetical, and the commandment is in verse 4. However, Yoel sees it differently, that it is not a hypothetical in verse 1, but an instruction regarding divorce when it comes to a certificate, and that has a very specific purpose. And so I should remind listeners that Yoel is my Hebrew teacher. He speaks Hebrew and reads Hebrew fluently, and I don't. So just bear that in mind as well.
Okay. So the way we read it in Judaism, and this is the way it's understood, and we practice based on that understanding, mm-hmm. is that there are two commandments here. One is, what exactly is divorce, and what is the grounds for divorce? So make it three commandments, or one that splits into two. Mm-hmm. And then another commandment of remarriage and returning. So we see there's two. Basically, the way you read it is not completely incorrect, okay? And the way I read it is not completely correct. Mm-hmm. It's really from both ends. But what I was trying to emphasize here is that you can't take it as a hypothetical clause, because it's trying to make a point. The point is that, what is the way you divorce a person? So first of all, what will be the grounds for divorce? So I'm going to swing into an area, because I've had a discussion with you about it, I had a discussion with other people about it. Mm-hmm. What exactly are the grounds for divorce? So in Judaism in general, we can't divorce left, right, and center. Okay, let's be very clear about it. But you can divorce more easily than what, for example, the Catholic Church would, or any other person. Why? Because in Judaism, ervat davar, we connect ervat davar together with she just has no liking in his eyes, because he finds something of uncleanness. Now, the word erva in general, if we switch to the book of Leviticus, immediately after the issue of Yom Kippur, it actually appears twice, the word erva is used there for the nakedness of a person. Mm-hmm. Okay, we're talking about Leviticus 18. Okay, so the verses here, for example, we take verse 6, for example, each and every man shall, which will come close to his own flesh, you shall not come close to them to expose their nakedness. I am God, or I am the Lord. And the word there is also erva or ervat. That's ervat is a construct form, mm-hmm. but it still means the same thing. The word erva basically is a nakedness, but the word erva sometimes can also mean something which is hidden. This is why it's the nakedness, something which is hidden. So the way we understand it is, for example, not only adultery, and that's the issue, for example, in the book of Matthew, and I think it's Corinthians, maybe?
Yes,
I don't remember exactly.
So, yeah.
I'm not an expert. Mm-hmm. But it's been brought to my attention that the New Testament, or the first century writings, push this idea that the only reason you're allowed to divorce your wife is only if there's adultery in the picture. Mm-hmm. If anyone here has ever heard the issue of the house of Hillel and the house of Shammai, and I know Rico Cortez has been working a lot on this subject, and I've been a part of it. I've been able to enlighten a few issues in this. The issue between the house of Hillel and the house of Shammai was really an argument about how to interpret the Torah. Mm-hmm. And one of the things we see in the arguments there is, for example, the issue of divorce. Now, I don't remember exactly all the details. If anyone wants, I'll put a post on the post part. I'll put the exact quotation is exactly where it is.
Sure.
But they had arguments regarding a lot of issues, and one of them was probably about divorce, and where exactly were the grounds for divorce. And I think the house of Shammai take more of a strict form, strict idea, where they basically say you're allowed to divorce only if it's something very, very serious. And the house of Hillel say the opposite. They say, no, if there's a problem with her, between them, is also a ground for divorce, even to the extent, if everyone has ever seen Fiddler on the Roof again, mm-hmm. last time as well, tradition, there's also the last scene of the movie when they're exiled from the village,
yes.
the rabbi sits there in the synagogue with students, and the people ask him, even if she burns his food, and he says yes, even if she burns his food, and the discussion there is really around, can a man divorce? In what situations can a man divorce his wife? And the rabbi was asking a basic question in the Tractate of Gittin. The word we use today for the bill of divorce in the Torah, it says get kritut. Oh, sorry, sefer kritut. Sefer is book. Sefer basically is another word for you actually write it down on parchment or something, not on clay or anything like that.
Sure.
You actually sefer kritut. The word sefer is usually used for something which is written on parchment or animal skin. Maybe even papyrus.
Mm-hmm.
Wouldn't be surprised if papyrus is also in it, but something which is considered to be a sefer, a book, and he gives it to her. We use the word get today. The word get, I'm not too sure exactly where the word comes from.
I'm not too sure
if it's a Hebrew word. Pun?
I've heard that expression before, yeah.
So we call it instead of sefer kritut, we call it get kritut. It's a Mishnaic Hebrew.
Mm-hmm.
And he basically was answering, yes, one can divorce his wife even if she burns his food. We can do that in Judaism, but we don't work on it that easily, because basically if you go to a Beit Din, a house of court,
mm-hmm.
A house of law, mm-hmm. Beit is house of, Din is law or judgment.
Judgment, yeah.
And if you go to a Beit Din and you ask them, you want a divorce, they ask you what's the grounds of divorce. And the rabbi there, one of the rabbis' job there is usually you stand in front of three rabbis,
mm-hmm.
and the elder is the one in charge. He asks you, why do you want to divorce her?
And if your answer is because she burnt my food, it's likely that they're going
to... The rabbi is going to say, go to a marriage counselor. He's not going to allow to divorce that easily. He's not going to let it. If they don't... The rate of divorce in Israel is a lot lower than the U.S. because they don't allow the divorce that quickly. But people do get divorced, and most of the people getting divorced are from the secular world,
mm-hmm.
because they get married for the wrong reasons.
Mm-hmm.
But in the Jewish world, because we have a different, you know, in the religious world, we have a slightly different perspective of the issue of marriage and building a house in Israel, etc.
Mm-hmm.
Then we do have to, people take it a bit, you know. I'll tell you a story. I have a friend who had very good grounds for divorce,
mm-hmm.
and he decided he's going to keep on. And that was a very brave decision, and they're doing great now. Or I would say doing a lot better than what they did in the beginning.
Sure.
And he had very good reason for divorce. But according to Jewish law, he did have a very good reason to divorce her, and he did not do it.
Yeah.
And I'm very proud of him.
I love stories like that. And doesn't that again reflect on Hosea in a way?
Exactly.
When men they look at it and they go, I'm going to work through this. I can work through this. I'm a responsible human being, and I want to work through this. Even though it's a very significant thing that he or she has done, that maybe most people would call it quits over, I've made a commitment of marriage, a covenant of marriage, and I'm going to make it work. I love that.
So, grounds for divorce in the Jewish world, as I just mentioned, is a lot simpler than what for this adultery. But we do have to ask ourselves a very, very simple question. And this is what you said about extending the covenant.
Mm-hmm.
What happens if a person says, to death do us part,
mm-hmm.
or to put aside all women? What do you do in a situation like that? We have a problem with the issue of oath.
That's right.
Is taking an oath.
Taking a vow.
Not an oath, a vow, right? What is a vow? There's a difference between neder and shvua.
Okay.
And neder is a vow, oath is a shvua. So when you take an oath of something, you're saying it did happen, it did not happen,
mm-hmm.
or I will do, I shall do. And neder is really I will do and shall do. Well, really, shvua is for the things that happened in the past, and neder is something for the future.
Mm-hmm.
So a vow is for the future, and oath is for the past as well.
But it's the power of words, and it's so very, very important, and it's required of us to keep our vows, to live up to them, right?
Exactly. So in our private discussion prior to the recording, you did ask a very simple question, and you were advancing more and more all the time, was what happens if a person takes a vow or an oath, actually a vow in this case, and it's a problem. The person took in the Torah itself. There's no. If we look at the issue of oaths and vows in the Torah,
mm-hmm.
If you take a vow, you can never get rid of it. You can never omit it. There's no way. Jews somehow developed in Judaism, we somehow developed this understanding that you can. I don't see it in the Bible. And this is why, for example, Yiftach HaGiradi had to sacrifice his daughter.
That's right. There was no in way Judges.
Of him. Exactly. There was no way of him not doing it.
He made, so the a, he made a stupid vow. He was in battle. He said to God, if you get me out of this, he said, I'll sacrifice the first thing I see when I return home.
No, what is the first thing that comes out of my
first
house?
First thing that comes out of my house. What a stupid thing to say. What an idiotic thing to say. And yet, that is what he did. Now, it doesn't say that God delivered him from the battle because of that. It just so happened that he was delivered from the battle, and yet he had made a vow. The first thing that comes out of the house was his daughter. And he exactly. said, oh, my goodness. And this
is why the book of Proverbs repeats it many times. Never take an oath. Never make agreements. Never make agreements. Protect your mouth and you protect yourself. Yourself. So you have to be very, very careful what you say.
So there's another example of that, obviously.
Life, by the way.
I was just going to say there's another example of that, obviously, in Joshua. The people from the land of
The Gibeonites.
There we are. And they dressed themselves up with old wineskins and stale bread and old shoes and said, we've come from a far land. Now make a covenant with us that we'll be allies, that you won't kill us, and so on and so forth. They became, eventually, they had to honor, the people of Israel had to honor that vow. And they became the wood carriers, water carriers for them, right?
Exactly. So you have to be very careful what vows you take. And really, a person who takes a vow like that has a problem. Mm-hmm. He can't divorce because he took a vow never to divorce. Mm-hmm. And even if he somehow, you know, gets rid of the marriage, you know, unless she dies. But if, you know, for example, they separate, and hypothetically speaking, she never goes and remarries because she's still married, he can't have a spouse.
Mm-hmm.
They're stuck.
They're stuck because they've made a vow. And this is worth mentioning because in Western society these days, it's the vast majority of ceremonies include these kind of words, and we make these vows, and that has to be taken into consideration. So it's an interesting thing that here we are in Deuteronomy 24, and we've voiced a couple of different ways of looking at it. But despite that, there is the example of David and Michael that you and I discussed earlier on. Do you want to fill people in on that one?
David and Michal.
Yep.
So Michal, you call him Michael, it's really Michal.
Mm-hmm.
The story is that basically David, King Saul had two daughters, Merav and Michal, and Saul tried to trick David to marry his daughter, so he basically proposed that he marries his daughter.
Mm-hmm.
And he has to go to battle against the Philistines to bring 100 Philistine foreskins. He brings 200. It's kind
so
of
he basically
he's up with a box full of.
He paid for his wife with a sack of foreskins. Isn't that nice?
Exactly, with a sack
romantic.
Of foreskins.
Yeah,
it's romantic. I'm not too sure.
Not quite
but
as
it's romantic-ish or bravery.
You know. Yeah, that's true. Okay.
The bravery is what's romantic here.
Okay.
The knight on the white horse, yeah. And he marries her, and you can see they're married because, for example, when Saul sends people to take a hold of him, they're living in the same house, and yes. She hides him in the bed. So they're married.
Yep, and says that he's sick and he can't go, and he escapes out the window, and so on and so forth. And that was probably the last he saw of her until he sends for her. And what situation is she in?
She's together with a man called Paltiel ben Laish, and it seems that they're married.
It seems like that.
And he calls to he speaks to the house of Saul, whoever's left, and he says, "I want my wife back."
Yeah. And so what happens is not only does he send someone to go and get her, and he bring and this person, was it Abner?
Just Avner, I think it was Avner. No, it might have been Avner. I don't remember exactly.
Might have been. Anyhow, but he's bringing her back, and the person who she has entered into a second marriage with, so it would seem, is crying and following her, and
he's following her and crying his eyes out.
Yeah,
and. And it's just the whole thing is just strange because what do you do? You know, what do you do with? So first of all, it wasn't Avner. It's immediately after Avner. It's Ish-boshet,
okay.
The son of Saul.
Yep.
And it's in 2 Samuel chapter 3, verse 14. Mm-hmm. And David sent messengers to Ish-bosheth, the son of Saul, saying, bring back my wife, Ishti, my wife, Michal, which I betrothed her for 100 foreskins of Philistines.
Mm-hmm.
So she is his wife.
Yep.
And he's emphasizing, I put my neck out to marry her. I endangered myself.
Mm-hmm.
She's married. She's married to David. So what on earth is going on?
Well, the point
it could be that they re-betrothed her to Palti ben Laish and they never actually got married.
Well, the point that you
brought up, there's a problem there. I mean, I don't know. Let me look at the word here for a second, because I think it says in verse 16, Ve'ilechita isha. Isha is her husband. It's another form for her husband.
Mm-hmm.
So the whole thing is just strange. So what the rabbis try to explain is that Palti ben Laish never actually consummated the marriage. He knew she was married, and he said never. But he did love her, so he did cry his eyes out. But the whole case is very, very strange, and I have no real explanation for this.
But what we do know, and as you pointed out earlier when we were off air, is that in accordance with Deuteronomy 24, if your point of view is correct about that, it is that David never gave her a certificate of divorce. He never divorced her. She was always his wife. She was never available to another man. And although there was some sort of a ceremony, it was not acknowledged. It was not legally acknowledged. She was always David's wife.
Mm-hmm, exactly.
So therefore, he could take her back.
Exactly. But if the marriage was consummated, she's an adulterous woman.
There's an act of adultery.
He can't take her back.
There's an act of harlotry, but he chose to take her back. And again, we're in Hoshea.
Again, we're in Hoshea, but if we take to, we have the emotional part, we have the technical part. The technical part is he's not allowed to remarry her. So it's the whole thing is strange. I agree. I do not have an answer for this one. I apologize.
That's all right. Well, we look forward to any opinions in the comments section on that one. We look forward to hearing from listeners there. What else should we look at? There is also the verse that says that God hates divorce and it covers garments with violence. Now, what is the context of that verse?
So we're looking at Malachi, if I remember correctly.
Malachi.
Yep. But we have to understand the context of the time. So to understand the context of the time, we have to go to the book of Ezra and Nehemiah.
Mm-hmm.
And Ezra and Nehemiah speak about the Jews of Judea marrying these foreign women. But we have to go all the way back. We're looking at which the verse? Which was the verse you were?
Yeah, I'm just finding it now. Actually, I'm in Malachi, and I want to find it. And it is chapter 2, verse 16. It says, "For the Lord God of Israel says that He hates divorce, for it covers one's garment with violence," says the Lord of hosts. Therefore, take heed to your spirit that you do not deal treacherously. Now we read in the verse before. Let none of your treacherously.
I would say read from verse 13.
Okay, good
read
idea.
From verse 13, and then you will see the whole picture.
And this is the second thing you do. You cover the altar of the Lord with tears, with weeping and crying, so He does not regard the offering anymore, nor receive it with goodwill from your hands. Yet you say, for what reason? Because the Lord has been witness between you and the wife of your youth.
Stop for a second. Mm-hmm. Covenant, okay. When a person marries a woman, it's in front of God. So it's a covenant. Amen. Remember that.
Amen. With whom you have dealt treacherously, yet she is your companion and your wife by covenant. But did He not make them one, having a remnant of the Spirit? And why one? He seeks godly offspring. Therefore, take heed to your spirit and let none deal treacherously with the wife of his youth. There we go. He seeks godly offspring.
That's exactly. Why? Zera Elohim, Evakesh Zera Elohim, Uma Ha'echad, the one, this Ha'echad, I think, would be God Himself. So there's different ways of reading this verse, but I've seen many different interpretations of the verse. But I would say Ha'echad here is God, and He's looking Zera Elohim, the seed of God. Why? What is the context here? The context here goes back to what went on in the time of the Second Temple, the beginning of the Second Temple. Mm-hmm. People were marrying or arrived married to a woman, and they come here, and they have all these Gentile women from Ashdod and Ashkelon and from other cities which were not Jewish. And they go and they marry them as well. Mm-hmm. So besides the issue of having a problem with marrying women who are not, you know, women who are from the land who are not Jewish, they're also abandoning their Jewish wives for these women.
Mm.
And what the context, at least this is what I see, is God is basically saying, what on earth are you doing? You're breaking your covenant with your wife to go run around with these I'm using the word run around just to emphasize it, but to be with these non-Jewish women? What is this? So and having children which will be raised to be pagans.
Mm.
You know,
and isn't that exactly what it says? It says when they're in the desert coming towards the promised land, and he said to them, don't go taking wives of the pagan nations, lest they you know, bring you into worship their gods and do as they do. And one of the things that it reminds me of as you were speaking is that we read in Bereshit that God, one of the reasons he chose Abraham is because he knows that he will command his children after him. And this is what he wants, obviously, is that he wants obedient children. He wants loyal and obedient children, and he wants marriages that are going to produce that. And people who are like-minded and on the same page, if you like, in the covenant and not outside of the covenant, because that will not produce godly offspring. Is that fair?
I would say that's fair. So that's the historical context of these verses. So it's not as if you're not allowed to divorce, but he actually uses an interesting word here. In the end of verse 15, it says, "Nishmartem beruchachem uveeshet ne'orecha al yivgod." So the word "yivgod" is to betray, and it's more of a hint that they're still married, but they're going with someone else. They're having a relationship with another woman, and in this specific context also, a woman who's not part of the people of Israel. So it's not as if you're not allowed to divorce. It's just, you know, don't betray your covenant with your wife.
Mm-hmm.
That's really what he's saying here. Right. But I would say there's another issue here, because if we attach this to the book of Hosea, he's talking about if you understand the issue of covenant between husband and wife, you understand the covenant between God and Israel.
Mm-hmm.
And
I think that's very valid.
Yeah, though I disagree with a certain teaching in the Hebrew Roots movement about the husband and the wife, the way it's taught there, and the bill of divorce and everything, I would say that the idea of the husband and wife is valid. But it's in the text. It's in the Torah. It's in the Bible. But to translate it the way I heard it been translated is a bit, you know, how to connect it to Yeshua and everything is in my opinion a bit is off. But in general, the concept in general is correct.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, there's certainly many different views regarding that. But let's stick with the Tanakh because otherwise we'll go right up. We'll never come back. So we've looked at Malachi, we've looked at Deuteronomy, we've looked at the example of David and Michael, we've looked at the example of Hosea. Is there anything else we should highlight?
We never really touched on all the technicalities of divorce, but I think that's not that relevant.
Mm.
By the way, regarding divorce, anyone who's a Kohen, for example, there's a bit of an issue there. Kohens have limitations of who they can marry.
Mm.
A Kohen can't marry a divorced woman, for example.
Mm-hmm.
This is all in the book of Leviticus. Let's actually flip to the book of Leviticus to look at this. It's in the book. It's in the Parsha of Emol. So we're looking at Leviticus 21.
Mm-hmm.
It gives a whole list about who they're allowed to go, the dead they're allowed to be in touch with, and everything. And we look at verse 7. It says, "An isha zona v'chayla lo yikachu." So isha zona is basically a prostitute.
Mm-hmm.
And chalala, there's a different discussions what chalala is. I personally think chalala is a woman who was raped, okay?
Mm-hmm.
But because if it's a woman who is some people say chalala is a woman who's loose with men, but that's what we call prostitute.
Sure.
So there's a different word for money or not, it's still a form of prostitution.
Sure.
Pardon, I didn't hear what you said.
I was just saying, so there's a different word for that altogether that could have been used in place of that. So it could certainly mean that she was raped, yeah.
Yeah, chalala from the word chalal or mechulal. Basically, it means something that's been defiled. So I would say a rape woman. That's what I personally think, and I asked other people and asked someone else, and they agreed with me. It says, "Lo ikachu, they shall not take." V'isha gerusha mi'isha lo ikachu, and a woman who's divorced from her husband, they shall not take. Ki kadoshu le'eloh, for he's sanctified to his God. So a widow, he's allowed to marry. Okay, so a kohen is allowed to either marry a virgin
or a widow.
Or a widow.
Okay.
So the question is, we have questions. Oh, so then if I say that in Judaism, sometimes they say a chalala is not necessarily is a woman who not necessarily was raped. She had a sexual relationship with a man who is not allowed to be in the crowd of Israel. Maybe a bastard. And there's a bit of discussion with what a mamzer is in the Torah, but for now we'll use the word bastard because we're dealing with the rabbinical interpretation, and a woman who had sex with a Gentile, or with someone from the people who are not allowed to convert, an Ammonite or a Moabite, things like that. But really, I think halala is just a woman who was raped.
And you know, you've just touched on something that we have to come back to. So, I'll let you finish your point, but I'm just going to write a note there. Okay, keep going.
Okay. So, either a Kohen is either allowed to marry a virgin or a widow, and a woman who slept with someone else might also be in the context of halala because she's defiled herself. Because in the ancient world, when a woman sleeps with another man, they're not married. It's a form of defilement. But also, if a woman is never been married and she's found not to be a virgin, and she really did so, we go back to the book of Deuteronomy. She's to be executed. You know, next to the door of her father. Okay, because it's a disgrace for the family.
Sure.
By the way, in the Arab world, they do that. In the Arab world, there have been cases of honor murders. Honor killings. And I don't think it's on the Arab world, but I know this in the Arab world because we have cases like that here in Israel, that a brother murders his sister because she disgraced the honor of the family. And I even know, and this was insane, when I was a teenager, there was a half Druze, half Arab village, and there was a war in the village. There was an actual war in the village, and we're talking about weapons, hand grenades, everything, because an Arab girl was dating a Druze kid, and they had a sexual relationship. And the family of the Arab girl discovered this, and they fired the police. They actually had to get the military in to stop it.
Man, that's incredible, isn't it? It gets very, very serious.
And you should know that the Druze and the Arabs are enemies. They hate each other. And I have no idea how this village exists, but it's a half. One side of the village is Druze, the other half is Arab, and they're able to live next to one another until someone disrespects someone else. And the Druze here in Israel joined the Israeli army because they just want to fight the Arabs. They hate the Arabs.
Wow. Goodness.
So the Druze are actually a very old inhabitants of this area.
Wow. So now, just before, can I just digress a second? You mentioned, and maybe we'll have to end on this because we're running out of time, but you mentioned a Moabite is not allowed to convert, and I know a lot of people are going to think, hang on a second, there is a verse that says that somewhere, but wasn't Ruth, didn't she marry an Israelite man who died, and then she remarried later on Boaz, of course. So how do we figure that one out?
So there's two explanations. Either, yes, we're not supposed to do that, or that the word there is Moavin Amoni in the masculine form. So one of the explanations is that he's allowed to marry only a woman, only a Moabite, a man, is not allowed to convert, and the women are allowed. But we have a problem with that explanation regarding King Solomon, because when King Solomon marries, he also marries Moabite, Edomites, Lodi, etc., etc., etc. And if you look at the list, you can actually ask yourself, and then it says, from the nations that God forbade us from marrying, and look at that, and you go, okay, we have a problem. So I don't have, another dilemma I have. I don't have a clear answer on this one.
Can I propose something and ask your opinion on this? When she confessed to Naomi and she said, may your people be my people, may your God be my God, where you will go, I will go, and where you die, I will die, and so on and so forth, is she not there and then professing that she wants to be in the covenant of Israel? Is she not then part of Israel?
Exactly. So this is why I'm saying that she accepted her to convert. Boaz, who was agreed to marry her. The nation itself, the elders in the gate, accepted the marriage. And so we have to look at the interpretation a bit differently. We have to accept this interpretation that it really means a man and not a woman. Because you have to remember, genealogy goes for the father. So if, oh, he's a descendant of a Moabite, he's a descendant of an Ammonite. But when it's a woman, no one thinks of what the mother was. People are like, okay, yeah, the father is the father. You know, that's the way the genealogy goes through. That's what people care about. So the whole idea is it's a punishment for the Moabites and Ammonites that they're not, when the Israelites came to the land of Israel, they didn't allow them to, they didn't let them in with bread and water and they greeted them. So it's a punishment. So it's basically not allowing their name to carry on inside Israel. But this is why I think it's really, and when you look at what King Solomon, it's the verse there, the word there, I'm paraphrasing here, probably mishmashing several verses together, but I think that verse, that part of the verse is only speaking about the women who would really not allowed to marry, like Canaanites and Hittites and whatever it would be.
Sure.
And the Moabite women and the Ammonite women you're allowed to marry, because, for example, Edomite women, you know, they can convert. You know, Edomites can convert. Egyptians can convert.
Mm-hmm. Fascinating topic. It's another difficult one. So again, we welcome comments on that one. Is there anything else in regards to marriage or divorce that we should touch on before we wrap this up?
I think on the technical level we've covered it. I think all married people more or less know where it is. But we connected it to the verses, connected it to the meaning of it inside the Bible regarding the relationship in God and man, and the relationship between man and woman. I think we've more or less covered it. I mean, you know, again, you always have like technical questions, individual questions. This happened, that happened, and that's already something, you know, more into detail that people have to ask, you know, someone who understands in these subjects and is able to answer these questions.
There's some information for consideration, some food for thought, and just to let everybody know, Yoel's marriage is doing really well, and my marriage is doing really well, and that's not the reason why we were talking about it. It's just sometimes people ask questions, and we have these conversations, and so we thought it's not an uncommon one, as you well pointed out. Yoel, the rate of divorce is extremely high, and so it's certainly one that's on a lot of people's minds. In fact, probably at least 50% of the population would be undergoing some sort of pressure or stress or experience that is relative to this topic. So again, my friend, thank you for your time and for your expertise in the text, and I hope it gets people thinking and answers some question for them.
I hope so as well. And I want to explain something just before we finish. I want to say one more thing, is that if we get the subject of love and marriage correct, we'll be able to solve a lot of problematic, immoral and immoral behaviors in the world. I myself, I'm shocked by the level of irrational behavior between couples, the irrational behavior of people towards sex, towards everything. The real problem is, the real issue is that if someone really truly loves his wife, he will never look at another woman. Do you have any idea what that will do to the industry of pornography?
Oh,
it will kill it.
It'll kill it.
It will completely and utterly destroy it. And this is one of the biggest problems I see today on that level in society. I'm not talking about violence and stuff like that. I'm talking about personal issues in between people. I mean, men and women. If people treat this covenant they have with their wife seriously take it to heart, they will not have the function in their minds to do anything of that sort. That will completely kill this ghastly and such immoral and immoral thing in the world. It will completely destroy it, and it will save us as people, because it's you know, you look at the story of the daughters of Moab, when they distracted the Israelites from going the way of the Torah and called them over, and they had sexual relationships, basically not real relationship, sex with these Moabite women. That was that time's equivalent to pornography. And God was so angry with it and poured his wrath. People died because of it, and it is such a disgrace for humanity that we have this.
This is the example when what was his name?
Pinchas.
Yeah, and thrust a spear through both of them to put to an end what was a plague, was it not, from God? if I recall correctly. So it's a very, very serious thing. In any case, no, I'm glad you brought that up, and I agree with that. And so again, information for consideration, food for thought, and you know, we pray that it blesses some people, and we would love to hear comments on your thoughts from the listeners. In the meantime, be blessed and be set apart by the truth of our Father's word. Shalom.